Hello and welcome to the UMFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. This week's episode is part two of our discussion on modern monetary theory and its potential impact on public policy. This is Pierre Orlieb from London, and today we welcome back Robert Hockett, Cornell Law School professor and Bernie Sanders presidential campaign advisor, and Torvald Grungmo, former special advisor at the Norwegian Central Bank and research associate at the Levy Institute.
So I just want to shift gears a little bit slightly and really kind of home in on inflation and monetary policy. So Bob, you mentioned earlier this idea that inflation is a relation between money and sort of things that can be purchased, goods and services. But it seems to me like there's a particular approach to grappling with inflation in the MMT framework, right? So I think that's partly because one sort of component of the Keynesian slash post-Keynesian approach is to keep interest rates at zero, so that kind of limits the role of monetary policy. But on the other hand, you also have the more policy-oriented components, such as the job guarantee, which, from what I understand, is inextricable from this MMT understanding of money and finance. So I think maybe we can start with Torvald here. What is the role of policy in grappling with inflation under this framework?
Well, if I can make two points. One is a more general point, because I think there is a lot of discussion in the social network about MMT, and there is a lot of different views, and yet some people are very excited about this, and they tend to characterize the other part as quite stupid or nonsense or whatever. And I'm sort of trying always to seek a middle ground. And in that sense, I think when we discuss these different ways of running monetary policy in particular, I mean, there are grades and there are extremes. And one extreme, which has been characterized for MMT, is that, as you alluded to, that interest rate would be kept at zero. And then some would say that taxes will be going up and down and it would be very difficult to control and expenditure. Public expenditure would also be going up and down. And so that's heavy criticism of the MMT framework. And also adding the job guarantee. Definitely, MMT would see the job guarantee as a much more flexible policy tool, and it would be sort of a bit of an automatic stabilizer. It works as constructed. But I think that you could certainly think of transitions here by degree. I mean, you don't need to buy wholeheartedly into one or the other to see that the current policy regime is clearly not working very well. And there is absolutely a bit of convergence of views. The mix between monetary policy and fiscal policy should change. And so to me, it seems like some of the discussions is a bit construed in the sense that definitely should be ample space to find some way of making better policies. You don't need to embrace the full MMT package to see that that can be done.
To complement what Torvald said, Pierre, I was just going to say that I think there's a mistake that is commonly made when people sort of interpret what they hear from some of the principal proponents of MMT. So what they'll hear from the principal proponents is that taxes are not about raising money so that the government then can spend money, but rather they are a kind of counter-inflationary measure that's to be deployed in the event that inflation pressures build up in response to government spending, right? So they'll say, in effect, they reverse the order of taxing and spending, sort of in the way that the proper understanding of banks reverses the commonplace of deposits making loans, right? So again, the sort of orthodoxy is that deposits make loans. The truth is that loans make deposits. The MMTers will say the orthodoxy is that taxes enable spending, whereas the truth is that spending sometimes necessitates taxes, you know, sort of after the fact. Now, that is all well and good, but note what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that taxation is the only anti-inflationary tool. It doesn't mean that that's the sole way to deal with inflation. No MMTer says that, but many people, I think, mistake them for saying that. And that's a particularly important point for me, at least, because one of my principal areas of expertise and what I teach my students at Cornell is financial regulation. And much of financial regulation, in my view, is best understood and interpreted as itself being all about modulating credit aggregates economy-wide, which is another way of saying it is a form of macroeconomic monetary policy, in effect. So to make the point easily graspable as a matter of intuition, go back to the simple bank transaction I mentioned, right? How much lending banks can actually do, and thus how much money banks can actually generate, is determined primarily not just by the sort of profits that might be had by making investments, i.e. extending credit, but also by what they're permitted to lend and under what circumstances they're permitted ordered to lend by the regulatory regime, by the regulatory structure. The best known form of bank regulation is typically thought of or referred to as capital regulation. That's just another way of saying leverage regulation. And what you say is, look, your asset portfolio has to be a multiple of your shareholder equity. And that means in turn that the total lending you can do is constrained by how much equity capital you can raise. If we raise that amount, right? If we say, if in effect we say you're not allowed to lever as much, you need more equity in sort of as a proportion of your asset portfolio, we are in effect trimming credit aggregates, and that means we are in effect trimming the money supply. So financial regulation itself is ultimately itself largely about monetary policy, about anti-inflation or counter-inflationary policy, and it's a great complement to tax policy in that way. Also, like tax policy, it can be targeted, right? If there's a subprime mortgage bubble underway, that means there's too much credit in the subprime mortgage markets. That means that's a great place to target with much more stringent leverage regulation, for example, or the imposition of loan-to-value ratios or debt as a percentage of income ratios for individuals and so on and so forth, right? So very important point, I think, for people to bear in mind.
I'm totally in agreement with Robert here, and I think for too long the policy kit has been constrained by you're primarily looking at interest rates as the key lever of monetary policy. But if you go back 30, 40 years, you know, there was a lot of credit budgets, credit constraints, credit guidance, and then we sort of decided that private markets should allocate capital because they were better fit to do that. And then I think we've had one crisis, at least two, three financial crises, which has shown that that may not be the case. And so I think there is a regime now of capital ratios and stuff, but it's become very complicated. And I see credit policy as being clearly a lever that should be used more forcefully, especially if you look at this in the climate change discussion, where in order for the economy to command resources to address the climate change challenge, you need to constrain private sector expenditure for real resources. And so there is a trade-off, and we need to have a discussion about complementary policy levers, not only interest rates.
I recall reading a few weeks ago that, you know, things like price controls even and things like that were much more common in the 60s in the Johnson presidency than they are now, that a whole toolkit of levers seems to have evaporated. So I'm sympathetic to the argument that this array of different measures, as you mentioned, credit policy, regulation, could be more effective in grappling with inflation as part of this framework. And certainly given the performance of central banks over the past decade or so, I think anyone would be inclined to agree. But I think, let me just push back on that, though. At least from a political economy angle, it seems like there isn't really a constituency or there isn't really the support required to use that array of measures. I think there would possibly be too much resistance from certain interest groups, certain sort of involved parties for those measures to be adequately used. Is that a concern that you have as well? Or?
Absolutely. First thing you hear when you talk about credit guidance is that, oh, well, you don't want to go back to a repressive financial system because it was old bad days. So clearly it will be resistance. But I've just, as Robert has, been working on this climate change just recently, and time frame is so short. You've had these demonstrations in London recently. And if you take the parallel with the war effort, I read someplace that FDR actually prohibited production of private cars in order to enable factories to switch to wartime production. Now, that's a command economy. You don't necessarily want to go all that way out, but clearly there should be acceptance for some change in the way we run the economy in order to address that major challenge. So I think this is clearly a discussion that is coming up.
Again, I couldn't agree more with Torvald, and might also be worth noting in this connection, Pierre, that the best known, probably the most celebrated American Fed chair ever was William McChesney Martin. He was appointed by, I believe, Truman, and then served until the very early Nixon years. So he was the longest serving Fed chair. And he's probably best known today for two very memorable adages or sort of one-liners that he emitted. One was that the job of the Fed is to take away the punch bowl just as the party is getting good. And the other was that the job of the Fed is to lean against the wind, which is another way of saying that it should act countercyclically. Now, if you think about this, right, I mean, something that lawyers are quite mindful of is there's something that's often referred to in connection with the court system, and that is the so-called counter-majoritarian difficulty. The idea is that courts are meant to arrive at decisions dispassionately on the basis of the law, not on the basis of sort of fleeting public passions. And so for that very reason, they sometimes have to be counter-majoritarian. They have to act against the majority from time to time on the theory that they have cooler heads questions about the matter at hand, and the public might, for brief moments at least, not have the right, you know, sort of attitude or frame of mind or knowledge, right? Now, if you think about it, a counter-majoritarian has the word counter in it. Another word that has the word counter in it is the word counter-cyclical. And this is what central banks and finance regulators are meant to do. I think in both Torvald's view and my view, they're meant to be counter-cyclically acting collective agents. They act on behalf of us all, even when that means sometimes acting against us all, at least when the area in which they're acting is indeed an area that falls within their legitimate expertise and purview. But reasonable minds can disagree about what that scope is. And for that very reason, there's always bound to be a certain degree of political fraughtness to questions of central bank intervention or other finance regulatory interventions, particularly when they're kind of micro-targeted. But that's something we just have to kind of live with. It's also, by the way, I think one reason that central bankers often are given long terms. In the U.S., the Fed board positions a 14-year position, and it's also why they have a great deal of discretion and insulation against legislative pressure. But as Torvald would know better than I, even though I used to work at the Fed, central bankers know that they have this discretion, but they're also mindful of the fact that they could lose it if they elicited too much outrage or outcry. So they tend to sometimes to err on the side of caution when it comes to using that discretion.
Let me just ask you this, but even given the degree of independence that the Fed enjoys and the long terms that board members tend to have, I think only one of the current Fed board members has actively called for countercyclical capital buffers. I think the remainder of them have been sort of quite passive on this issue, even despite the pressures that you see building in certain asset markets, or say in particular equities. Why is it that even in spite of this, the Fed has been so reluctant to pursue these kind of countercyclical or countermajoritarian buffers? I mean, it's quite puzzling to me.
Because I'm with the central bank now, and I'm able to say that I think the countercyclical buffer is really only a marginal tool compared with what you need to address the credit markets today. I mean, I've been through Basel I, Basel II, Basel III, and it's become hugely complicated, and the countercyclical buffer is there. It will have absolutely no effect if you have a credit score of some sort. And it's just, excuse me, nonsense. And discussing whether it will be used or not is beside the point. Again, with the climate crisis ahead of us, and we have 12 years to address whether we have an Earth, a livable Earth or not, I find that discussing the countercyclical buffer is just absurd. That's why I do think that in terms of directing resources, we should much rather look to China and to the Asian countries that actually are using credit policies very actively in their industrial policies, addressing pressing needs. And I just read a working paper by the IMF recently where they are in the process, I think, of embracing some of this, what they call TIP policy, or technology and innovation policy. Pick winners, be brave, and put resources where you think they will make a difference. And forget about countercyclical buffers. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Bob, you were going to say something as well?
Yeah, so I guess 2 points. One, in response to what Torvald just said, and then the other a little bit more general. So I couldn't agree more with Torvald that if you get the allocation right, or if you do a better job of allocating, that per force will result in your doing a better job where it comes to modulating, right? So remember, I noted before that one of the principal tasks of financial regulation is to modulate credit aggregates. What we've tended to do in the modern Western countries, and especially here in the U.S. over the last 50 or 60 years, is to sort of adhere to a kind of implicitly, at least, to a kind of a rough division of labor, pursuant to which we say the public will handle the modulation task and the private sector will handle the allocation task, right? So private sector will determine where the money goes, and then the Fed, roughly speaking, or the central bank or monetary authority, roughly speaking, would determine how much money there is in total. It's a little misleading, however, to try to treat modulation of credit aggregates on the one hand and allocation of the spreads on the other as being completely orthogonal or completely independent of one another. Oftentimes, in other words, that which a kind of a prerequisite to there being an immense overgeneration of credit is there first being a terrific misallocation of credit, right? Credit was massively misallocated to the subprime mortgage sector and indeed to the residential home sector in the United States economy in the 1990s and early 2000s. That itself was the source of the excess credit aggregates, right? So if we had actually been a little bit less mealy-mouthed or less pussy-footed about allocating credit, which the Fed had the authority to do, and indeed it had the authority to regulate the mortgage finance markets, if we had been a little less pusillanimous about that in the 90s and early 2000s, or a little less doctrinaire about the private sector's right to determine allocation entirely, we might very well have avoided the crisis and the crash and crisis that we experienced here in the States and much of the rest of the world a little over 10 years ago. So I think that's the first point, right? And note that if you've got the modulatory task partly solved by doing the allocative task right, that itself means that acting countercyclically isn't as urgent a task as it otherwise would be. The second point I was going to make is a much more general one, which is that countercyclical action is indeed often difficult to take even when it does make sense, precisely because it's countermajoritarian, right? It is unpopular, sort of by definition. And so that means in turn that anybody charged with acting countercyclically has to be either very, very brave and firm and confident, or has to be kind of narrow-minded, or even, pardon the expression, an ass, right, or an asshole, right, who doesn't care what people think. Most people aren't like that, thank heavens. Most people do care what people think, and they do worry when they hear a lot of outcry about what they're doing. And that is precisely why somebody like Bill Martin is looked back on as a kind of hero, because unlike most people tend to do, he was able to stand firm even when the president of the United States in the 1960s was like 8 inches taller than he was, that's LBJ, and gave him the famous LBJ treatment when he thought that Martin was cutting back on credit aggregates too quickly in order to sort of preempt inflationary pressures as the Vietnam War expenditures took off in the later 60s.
Well, you've been telling us the story of MMT, Bob. You mentioned had the Fed been more aggressive in its allocation task, that it fully had the right to participate in the late 90s and early 2000s, then we may have had a chance to avoid the crisis. And part of me can't help but wonder, so this idea of MMT or functional finance or whatever you want to call it has been around since Abel Lerner, which was in the 40s, 50s. But these ideas have kind of ebbed and flowed, right? So we did have a period in sort of the post-war world in which regulation was quite prominent, capital controls were placed and also prominent, which is unthinkable now. Why is it that, without asking you to tell the history of the past century, why is it that these ideas, functional finance, MMT, have come to the fore now, come to the fore right after the Second World War? What explains their relative prominence?
Well, I'm sure Torval has a view on this, and so I'll be quick with mine, but I do indeed have one as well. And that is, you know, it seems that generally what happens when you have a significant financial crisis or economic crisis of the kind that kind of shakes the very foundations of an economy, it kind of naturally leads people to sort of rethink certain orthodoxies or conventional wisdoms that appear to have been implicated by the lead up to what ultimately happened, right? In other words, if the crash of 08 was a function or a product of bad policy, and if that bad policy, in turn, was at least partly a product of theory that academics had and certain central bank research departments had, then it's kind of natural for people to rethink or reexamine the orthodoxy that is implicated. Now, in the wake of 2008, there were a couple of fascinating things that emerged. One was that many central banks, certainly in the U.S. this was the case, employed models to describe and track the functioning of the economy and to try to predict what might happen in future that oftentimes underplayed, if they played at all, on the role of debt, the role of money, even the role of financial institutions in the economy. In other words, some of the models that were used appeared to have bought in effect, to the barter myth, that basically it's all ultimately at bottom about bartering, with money as just, again, a kind of an inconsequential veil that actually just obscures what's really going on under the surface. And if your model has those attributes, of course it's not going to notice that there's a massive private debt buildup underway in this or that sector of the economy, and hence it's going to miss precisely what was driving the bubble in the first place and precisely what resulted in a massive long-term Irving Fisher-style debt deflation once the crash actually occurred. So one way I think of viewing the kind of efflorescence or the sort of renaissance, you might say, of various heterodox schools of macroeconomic and monetary thought, including not only MMT, but also, as you said, Pierre, various post-Keynesian schools, monetary circuit theory schools, and even a kind of neo-Irving Fisher school of thinking that I think I'm more associated with myself. One reason that that's all sort of efflorescence or that renaissance is underway now is precisely because the orthodoxy has come up short. And we've seen this before too, right? There was all sorts of of new money thinking going on in the wake of the 29 crash. And indeed, much of Keynes's seminal contributions that we still cite to this day were themselves, in part at least, responses to what was perceived to have gone wrong, not only in practice, but also in the theory that had informed the practice in the lead up to the calamities of the 1920s.
I think in terms of why these ideas have come up now, and why didn't they come up after the financial crisis? Because, again, I did a bit of study of Minsky at that time, and there was an interest in Minsky after the crisis for a while, and then it dwindled off a bit. MMT was discussed, but not really, really taking off. I think a major part for the resurgence and interest now is discussion in the U.S., specifically related to the Green New Deal and the climate challenge. So I think that's one thing. The other one is, I think as the years has passed since the crisis, there has been increasing frustration about what I would call the policy consensus or the assignment between monetary policy and fiscal policy. And you see this frequently in publication and books now, that there are questions about the predominance of monetary policy. And that predominance was based on a theoretical model and a certain way of perceiving the economy, which had deep roots going back to the 60s in OECD, and primarily saying that the government should run its books on a balanced basis. The private sector was best suited to allocate resources, and free capital flows would flow between countries, and then everything would be nice and dandy. That hasn't proven to be the case. So I think those two things, I mean, the policy impotence, I would call it, combined with the challenges related to the climate change, is a combination of factors which has made MMT quite attractive.
So I'm getting the sense from both of your responses that there are three key components: the crisis and abandonment of the ideologies that led up to it being one of them, a sort of desire to move past monetary dominance being another one, and then finally, the last one being the urgency of the looming climate catastrophe. And I don't want to keep you both too much longer, but I think a good point to close on is something that you've touched on multiple times, Torvalds, is the threat of climate change and specifically the Green New Deal in the U.S. So I'd like to ask both of you for your thoughts on that, but specifically, Bob, if you could tell us about the links between the Green New Deal and the job guarantee and MMT. I know that you're personally involved in this project, so perhaps you can start us off on this.
Yeah, sure. So I've been doing a lot of work on the Green New Deal since last autumn, and some of it has been on just sort of the planning the process pursuant to which the Green New Deal will unfold. But a good bit of it also has to do with the financing and the financial questions that are going to be implicated by the Green New Deal. And so in a way, it's kind of perfect timing for you to ask about that right now, and also about the role that MMT might be playing or might in future play, insofar as it's not playing as big a role as it might now. So there are a couple things maybe to say in that connection. The first thing to say maybe dovetails this question with your previous question. So in addition to our sort of looking back at what went wrong intellectually in the lead up to the crisis, a lot of us these days are looking at what has gone wrong or at least been suboptimal when it comes to responses to the crisis, right? Because the responses are to some extent informed by departures from the prior orthodoxy, right? Indeed, they're partly determined by recognition on the part of policymakers that there were errors in the earlier orthodoxy. But by the same token, like any intellectual phase shift or seismic shift, these sorts of shifts take time. And so there's still a lot of traces of orthodox thinking among policymakers and legislators to this very day. They were very pronounced in Europe, of course, during the austerity period, but they were also prominent here in the U.S. during our own sort of flirtations with austerity. And I think many of us who have been pushing the Green New Deal and working on sort of conceiving and developing and unfolding the Green New Deal are of the persuasion or of the opinion that there's been much too much orthodoxy still informing the response to the crash in 08, and that that's the reason, in turn, that our recovery has been so tepid, right? Now, of course, somebody like Mr. Trump is going to point to the GDP growth rates on an annualized basis and say, look how we're growing, and point to sort of job creation, so-called job creation. But if you look just beneath the surface, it's still been a very tepid recovery. I mean, people are not being paid very well still. In other words, the so-called new jobs are not paying well. In many cases, you can meet one or two people every day who have like two or three of those jobs. We haven't had any sort of a redress to the drastic inequality of the wealth and income distributions that had already reached extreme states by 2008. So in many ways, it's sort of still business as usual, and we're still very reliant on private debt to finance the economic growth that we have, just as we were before 2008. So many of us who are pushing the Green New Deal view it as a chance to get it right this time when it comes to actually stimulating real spending in this economy and generating high quality jobs again that people can raise families on and the like. So that means in turn then that those of us who are developing the Green New Deal are talking a lot to economists and financiers and others who themselves, like we, reject much of the economic orthodoxy that ultimately led us into the trouble that we got in a big dramatic way in 2008. And so among the people we talk to are those who are proponents of MMT. We talk to other heterodox economists as well. We talk to other post-Keynesians as well. And again, most of us are one or another of this kind of person in any event. I have an economics and finance background in addition to the legal background. And insofar as I'm an economist, I'm a heterodox economist. So it makes sense, I think, that the MMT community would be a big part of all this because they've been a very prominent school of post-Keynesian heterodox economic thought. They've also got a much more well-developed and coherent vision than most other heterodox schools of thought have, and so that also renders them attractive as people to talk to. And again, on so many things, on most things that matter to me at least, they're so dead right. And indeed, they, as I mentioned before, I think we see eye to eye on pretty much everything. We just arrived at our beliefs by slightly different routes. So that's, I think, the story there. When it comes to the job guarantee in particular, two quick things, I guess. The first is that the Green New Deal is, we have to remember, as much about bringing about a more just and equitable economy as it is about bringing about a more earth-friendly economy. In our view, these really come down to the same thing. In other words, the justice component of the Green New Deal is not really a component. It's a constitutive feature. It's not a bug. It's a feature. It's right at the core of it. It's kind of easy to see why just by in any number of ways, but one way is just to think, what are the places in our country and what are the places in most countries that are the most dramatically environmentally degraded? Well, they're typically places where people are poor, where people are underpaid and have little in the way of economic opportunity. And that's no accident because that's where we send the trash, as Larry Summers himself once recommended notoriously back in the 90s in a World Bank memo, right? So if you want to kind of rescue the planet and prevent the end of life as we know it within a decade, it's best to start where you get most bang for the buck. And where you get most bang for the buck is precisely the place where people are most downtrodden, most poverty struck. And that means that saving the planet and rendering the economy more just are kind of, they come down to one and the same thing. They're extensionally equivalent, as the set theorists might say, I having been one of those in a previous life back when I was a doctoral student. So the job guarantee can be thought of under that heading. You can think of the job guarantee in a lot of different ways. You can think of it as an automatic stabilizer, as Torvald mentioned, and that's the way the MMT folk typically frame it, and I think they're quite sound in doing so. But you can also think of it as just a basic requisite of economic justice. I really do believe that one day we're going to look back on the present time and the time leading up to the present time and say, are you kidding me? Is there actually a time when there were people who wanted to be productive and take productive jobs, but they simply couldn't have them? I mean, how is that even possible? How can you call yourselves a society if you don't provide for the capacity of anybody who's ready to work and be productive to work and be productive and to live on that productivity? So it seems to me it's crazy that we haven't done this for the last century at least. And the fact that we're finally looking at it in a serious way now is a wonderful thing. And it's kind of natural that it would come with the Green New Deal, again, given the Green New Deal's emphasis on economic justice as well as environmental rescue.
I just wanted to say that in terms of the climate change, I mean, I'm an economist, not into climate science, but clearly the scale of the challenge is huge and it will require massive investments, much of it private, but a large part also patient public money. And at the same time, unfortunately, we have witnessed a sharp decline in public investment in most advanced countries over the last 10 years, in large part due to misplaced austerity policies. So there again, you have the MMT framework as sort of a, you need to turn the table around to see what's possible and not focus on the financial constraints. But really, climate change is coming big. MMT is supporting a much bigger role for public investments, which is very necessary.
I think that's a perfect gloomy and urgent note to end on. I don't want to keep either of you too much longer, unless you have anything to add at this point. But I think we've covered quite a bit, so
Well, I was just going to add one maybe final point on the job guarantee, and that is that I've recently done a fair bit of work on something I call systemically important prices. These are prices that enter as inputs into other prices and have long-term systemic effects. And we have one systemically important price right now that we all as a public recognize to be systemically important and hence authorize our central bank to act on, and that's the interest rate, right, the money rental rate. We view that as a systemically important price, and so we act and intervene in markets. Our New York Fed trading desk engages in open market operations, basically trading in securities every morning in order to affect and maintain a stable interest rate economy-wide. The thing I think is kind of worth noting is that there are other systemically important prices, too, beyond interest rates, and it's high time that we recognized it and got ready and allowed ourselves to act on them, too. And one such that is probably even more important than interest rates is prevailing wage and salary rates. And so intervening publicly in the market to keep wage and salary rates fluctuating within a narrow band, as we already do with interest rates, can be viewed as a systemically important activity in addition to being a basic requisite of decency and justice in any polity and economy that likes to call itself civilized. So I guess that's the last point I'd make about that. But overall, my God, what a wonderful conversation.
Thank you very much to both of you.
It's been great to speak to you on modern monetary theory, public policy, the job guarantee, and many other topics. Next week's podcast is episode 3 of this year's Fed Talk series, where we discuss U.S. monetary policy decisions following the Federal Open Market Committee meeting. This will be available on the OMFIF channel on Tuesday, so you can download it once it's been broadcast or subscribe to our channel. If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us a review.